Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 384. Tuesday, December 15th, 2020.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. So I said I was going to share with you a recording from a drawing live stream with Dermot O'Connor, and I still intend to, but there's a much easier for me episode to produce, and it is from Monday of this week, and we're still talking about Dmitry Orlov's conspiracy narrative about how the pandemic response has been tailored to specifically injure the citizens of the United States and its allies. And so instead of hearing me talk about it with somebody, you will get to hear Kevin Lynn of Progressives for Immigration Reform talk about that subject and many others, I have to say, with Jim, your ad attacker from the Attack Ads podcast. They were both with me on the live stream on Monday of this week. So here's the first... Well, it's about an hour's worth of content, and it came pretty much in the first hour and a half of the conversation or of the live stream. So this follows, hot on the heels of the most recent podcast, and the topic is the same, so here we go. Alrighty. So you may have heard Jim's voice before. He does a podcast called Attack Ads. And he's been a guest on the Sea Realm on multiple occasions. And Jim and I were going to talk about a post that Dmitry Orlov put out, I think just to his paid followers. Somebody sent it to me. And, I can't read it aloud out to the world because it is a, behind the paywall sort of thing. But I summarized it, and Dmitry basically is... I can't tell how much conspiracy he's theorizing, but he says... imagine that evil geniuses run the economic world, not in Russia or China, but, the rest of the world. And they really want to put the screws to the U.S. They basically want to use up, what's left to be used in the U.S. and then hang it out to dry. And he says that the COVID response has, been designed with that end in mind. And, Jim, I think you've read the piece more recently than I have. Am I twisting it severely here, or is that pretty much what he has to say?
No, that's pretty close. It does seem to me to be an explanation for the COVID response, if not the COVID virus itself.
Yeah, I don't recall anything in there where he explicitly said that the virus was deliberately engineered. Although, from my perspective, no. That's not beyond the pale.
Well, no, but go ahead, Kevin.
Oh, I was going to say, there's enough evidence, I believe, out there, and I don't think it's a conspiracy theory, that this virus did originate in a lab in Wuhan. I mean, even the Chinese have admitted it came from the lab, only its release was unintentional, which I also buy. My big issue with the virus is, what are the Chinese doing with a level 4 lab anyway? I mean, these are the people that build cities with no one in them, wind farms with no hookup to utilities. You can't believe any of the accounting data coming out of any of the companies they list on their stock exchange. So,
well, Dmitry's got a particular brand, and his brand is pretty anti-American these days. So, in his narrative, China and Russia are pretty heroic actors in this.
I don't see China as heroic myself. Are you referring to one of his blogs that he did on November 30th where he talks about the election?
No. Let's see.
Okay, I missed whatever that is. Okay.
Well, somebody sent me a PDF of it. It's clearly... for people behind a paywall. So It's not a public post that he's put out. Let's see. I'll find that. Here we are. No, that's not it.
Okay. Because sometimes I read his stuff, because I'm behind his paywall. I do have a subscription, and but I just don't recall that one.
Okay. Well, if you're already behind the paywall, then I can send you this with no reservations.
Great.
So I have just forwarded the email to you. Outing my source in the process, so...
I don't know. Mum's the word.
All right. So, Kevin, this program that I'm drawing in, this is Adobe Fresco. This is Adobe's answer to a very popular art program for the iPad called Procreate. And it's meant to be used with a touchscreen device, and I'm not using it with the touchscreen device. I'm just using it in my Cintiq here. And that means I can't zoom in. So zooming in and out is, you know, would be a pinch and a the opposite of the pinch, whatever that is called. And I can't do any of that. So this is a fun program for me to warm up in because I can't get lost in the details. You know, I cannot zoom in at all. So it's just it's just like a piece of paper. And I'm, you know, I'm not precious about it, and I just scribble for a while.
Now, do you have the layers and everything that you have with the other programs?
Yeah, layers are over here on the side. Really, everything is reachable except zoom in and zoom out. That I just can't do. And like I say, for my purposes, that's kind of useful. But it's got a neat feature, and that is I can export the drawing that I've just done here as a time-lapse video.
Oh, so, nifty.
Yeah, I'm generating a preview now, and you'll see it like in a minute and a half, I think.
Is that Madam?
Madam?
A ventriloquist puppet from 70s, early 80s.
Oh. I don't know. I'm just scribbling here.
Of course, it has wings as opposed to her little spindly arms, but for some reason
I think I remember
like
Madam. She was like a rod puppet.
Like yes.
Okay.
Like a part rod, part hand puppet.
Right. So anyway, from my perspective now, the drawing is you know, recreating itself at speed. You'll probably see that in a few seconds here.
All right, there it is.
I'll time it with a calendar.
Now, I'm sure an hourglass would work just fine.
I should also push play. Yeah, where's that? No, I shouldn't push play.
No,
I
don't think you have any control.
There we go.
That. So
now that's pretty cool.
All right. We'll advance it here.
All right. So let's grab another layer. Show you another fun thing I like to do. This is almost meditative. This is very fun. Turn off these layers, and let's see. Let's make it greenish. Now, there are tools called rakes, which I find very meditative. Grab a rake here. Come on. Oh, got a... Helps if I draw it with a different color than the one that's already down there. There we are. Okay, so a little darker, and let's make the rake bigger. There we are. So, you ever seen like monks at a Buddhist temple taking rakes and just, you know, raking the gravel in the Zen garden.
Zen, like a Zen garden kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, the pebble gardens.
So that's kind of what this feels like to me. Just raking the gravel. I sometimes think about doing a sort of Bob Ross type presentation where I'm just talking in a very, very calm and reassuring voice, very, very happy tone. You don't even really care what I'm drawing. You've just tuned in to
feel... Put a sunset in there. Yeah.
All right.
We're going to put a happy little tree over here.
There you go. Now, did anybody ever watch Bill Alexander?
Because no, because I couldn't draw to save my life, so no.
Well, Bob Ross's
life.
Bob Ross's technique, where he can crank out a finished painting in 20 minutes, and sometimes have enough time to overdo it and like go too far with it. That's all taken from a guy named Bill Alexander, who had a show on PBS, a painting show, using this exact wet-on-wet method that Bob Ross was famous for.
And, I've seen him. Yeah, he's the one who like grabbed toilet paper and used that instead of a brush.
Yes, sir. Where he talks about his unmighty fan brush. That he likes to So, he's more commanding and more German than Bob Ross, but the painting style is identical. And basically, Bob Ross just took it from Bill Alexander and also took, the whole video format and just stole everything from his master and did better with it than the master did, in terms of success. Alrighty.
Yeah, I'm reading through Dimitri's article now. Yeah, I missed this one.
So I don't read his stuff regularly. So, some of what he had to say in there, I sort of had to try to read between the lines without any guidepost, or without any Rosetta Stone to help me.
Mm-hmm. So. Nothing when I've read his when I read his stuff, and we do communicate from time to time. I don't find anything untruthful about what he says. I think what it could be is just a matter of what is accentuated in his writings. And one of the problems I think here in the U.S. is we over-accentuate a Russian threat while at the same time minimizing the Chinese threat. To the U.S. And, I look back on the Soviet era KGB, and the KGB was all but a for-profit organization in that it more than paid for itself with the technology it was able to steal from the West. China today makes them look like pikers. When you think about the tech transfer that goes on, and it's not even clandestine. It's just moved via email, whether it's at the National Institutes of Health, where there have been FBI investigations and convictions. But it's all over. They've impregnated our... and it's all just coming out now. Their Ministry of State Security probably has about 2 million assets operating in the world right now, bringing in technology. So, I think we've chosen for some bizarre reason to demonize the Russians when we really should be, I think, focused more on the Chinese threat.
Now, Kevin, do you think it might be because of the mainstream connection and the Russian interference in the election and those more recent topical things since 2016 that we overemphasize the Russians?
I think it does stem from 2016 to the dossier, which has been proven to be a piece of opposition research that was designed to take down Trump in the campaign. And when it didn't, we began to see just how deep the tentacles ran into the deep state. At the end of the day, it's still a bunch of trolls on Facebook who spent about $50,000. And that's the only thing that can be pointed to. Whereas what? Clinton spent almost $1 billion on her campaign and didn't win. Yeah, I think we had what the deep state did was they demonized the Russians, and why not? They're really not. Of what utility are they to the United States at this point? other than more of a hindrance.
And one thing that comes to mind right away is that the people are demonizing tend to be those, and this is my focus, of course, who rely on revenue from advertising. So they can't exactly demonize the Russians and say, those people bought ads on Facebook, without completely looking hypocritical, because they're getting lots and lots of revenue to broadcast literal ads on their little formats between the times that they speak. So by overemphasizing the Russians, they have essentially deflected blame for the loss of Hillary Clinton in 2016, which they are largely responsible for themselves.
That's actually a great way to phrase it, I think. I mean, you put up an unlikable candidate like Hillary Clinton, and you put her against a Donald Trump who understands human nature, I think, as much as anyone does who's a player in politics, and he just clocked her. I mean, he basically decapitated his 12 rivals in the primary. I mean, that should have been telling to anyone what was going to happen in the general.
Yeah, well, she came in as a politician, and he came in as a reality show star. So he's a troll, and she's trying to be civil and civic and really did a good job, except when she branded half of his supporters as the basket of deplorables, which gave him enough material to just bury her the rest of the way, sadly.
Do you guys remember that the second debate? And because there were three debates, and he did really well on the first one. And then the second one, he pretty much lost. That seemed to be the consensus. And, I mean, I was watching and thinking, wait a minute, Trump, she's wide open. Hit her. And nothing. And then the third debate, he clocked her, and you should be in jail, and I'm thinking, it's almost like he was playing her. It's like, okay, I'm going to cede the second one, because it's like, if you go to Vegas and you win all the time, big deal, but it's when you lose and you feel you got to get that mojo back. I mean, all those people were in there, come on, Trump, do it this time. And it's almost like you said, that reality show, that ability to understand the audience and throw them the red meat at the right time. He seemed to be able to do just better than anyone else. And in a way, I think that election, the 2016 election, was supposed to be between Clinton and Jeb Bush. I don't think Trump was in the cards at all.
According to the movers and shakers that Dmytro Orlov is suggesting are actually in charge.
Right, right. And I think I do agree with Dmytro that there is a deep state. There are vested interests in, I see the United States as this multi-trillion dollar enterprise that they're just not going to trust anyone to run. They're going to be vetted very closely to make sure that they're not going to, take it off course or do something, God forbid they do what the people might mandate. So, I'm sure I sound like a conspiracy theorist at this point.
Well,
but
no, I kind of work for them. I'm a very small cog. I drive a bus. They don't let the wheels of the bus go round and round with anybody at the helm. It's a bureaucracy, of course. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you have to factor in, like you were saying, the Russians got technology and was able to self-sustain themselves. The KGB was able to self-fund. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, very effectively, too.
What were the technologies they went after? I'm curious.
Oh, when you look at, for instance, Northrop Grumman, they had, I forget the name of the fellow, they bought him initially. They paid him $50,000. And they were the KGB was very good. Their human intelligence operations were really good with respect to targeting tech companies, the defense contractors. I mean, that's how they got our stealth technology, and they did it through really human intelligence.
Okay. I was just going to say, our own CIA, as far as I can read, has been funding itself since the church investigations in the 70s, the church committee in the 70s. they have simply gone to growing opium overseas and distributing it as heroin in the United States mainly. Originally it was targeted by race, but, you know, they branched out.
Yeah, for every buck you put in, you get 10 back. What a racket, huh?
Too bad. Then they get the U.S. military to guard the poppy fields in Afghanistan and before that in Cambodia and Laos. I mean, that's well documented. Mm-hmm. They're just behind the times, being drug pushers instead of tech millionaires.
Yeah. Think about it. Yeah.
It's simpler. I mean, you have to spend a lot of money to build a microchip factory.
Yeah.
You have to spend to plant a poppy.
And make sure that the people over there are favorably disposed to it. Because, you know, I had a lot of issues with the Taliban, you know, destroying century-old art, architecture.
The Buddhas.
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, they pretty much ended, as I understood it, they ended the poppy trade, too.
Yes, exactly. And many theories said, I don't subscribe to any theory I'm not a part of. Many theories say that's why we went into Afghanistan. But whatever.
But above our pay grades, I think.
Definitely.
But in terms of pay grades,
you look in the background, you can see the CRT television.
Yeah.
In my defense, I need that for my video game. Because my video game plays a lot slower on an LCD, and I lose points.
Well, what do you play?
It's a silly game on the Wii. You probably never heard of it. It's a little sub-game in something called Wii Party. It's a Tetris-based, but a lot more fun.
Tetris-based, you said?
Oh, wow.
It's based on the game Tetris, but it's It's a premium. It's like one of the many Tetris clones, but they kind of added some features. It's addictive. That's all.
Well, that's, you know, my problem is I'm a compulsive obsessive, and that's why I stopped playing games in like 2004, or was it 2005? Something around there. 2005, 2006, somewhere around.
Obsessive compulsive would know the date.
Yeah,
yeah, probably would. But because I was really into Age of Empires, and I would literally watch the sun come up. You know, as
Civilization
like,
Four.
I am not being productive here, and I just had to get rid of everything.
I bounced back and forth when all my friends made the migration from Diablo 2 to World of Warcraft. I decided, no, I won't survive if all I do is play this and shit. That's all. You know. I just gave it up, and they were so angry that I wouldn't join them. Like, sorry guys, I can see where this is going.
Yep, really is addictive.
Indeed. So, Kevin, I don't think that Jim knows that you sat at a table with our illustrious president earlier this year.
I did. Spent an hour with the president on August 3rd.
Is this your version of Operation Valkyrie?
In a way, yeah, because it really was a scheme to get in front of him. And it started with me reading an article in The Intercept about these Tennessee Valley Authority workers, the tech workers, about 200 of them that were about to get displaced by companies that were going to outsource the work to H-1B visa-dependent companies. So I, being someone who knows a bit about employment non-immigrant visa programs like H-1B, OPT, L-1, O, all these. I went down there and spoke at a rally, and then driving back up to the Shenandoah Valley, thought, you know, the only person who could stop this is Trump, because the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, is this quasi-public-private organization. It's quasi-federal, it's quasi-private utility. And the president does select the board members, not the CEO, but the board members, and the board all, of course, hires and fires the CEO. So I got together with this agency and our in-house folks, and we created a 30-second ad. And the ad was, as Trump described it, he said it was vicious, but it made him think. And we went after Trump and this guy Liash, who was the CEO for TVA, basically saying, you know, Trump, how could you allow this to happen? You know, you said you're going to be an America First kind of guy. And here they are displacing these workers and jobs are going to these H-1B visa dependent companies. And the ad wasn't the big issue. It was getting it in front of Trump. And we ended up having, we bought time on cable news channels that he, we knew he watched, for instance, Tucker Carlson, that's where he saw it. And I was having dinner in Alexandria, Virginia one night with an attorney, and all of a sudden my phone just blew up. You know, people were going, Trump just tweeted you. And he basically said, called us fake news. And everyone knows I hate that guy, the CEO of TVA. And by the way, who are these U.S. tech worker people? And then he started getting, Trump started getting ratioed by people like Ann Coulter, Michelle Malkin, who were saying, hey, you need to be talking to these guys. And then I got a call from the White House. And they said, hey, can you get together about 40 workers in Knoxville for Trump to visit with? And I said, sure. And then later it was like, can you get, you know, some workers up to D.C.? And we did that. So on August 3rd, we went into the cabinet room with 8 TVA workers, and we were there with Trump, Pence, Scalia, Cuccinelli, several others. We spent an hour with them, and he ended up firing the chairman of TVA and one of the directors. And then during that talk, the CEO of TVA called to say they were rethinking their decision on outsourcing these jobs. And, you know, the net result was we got an executive order that, at least as far as federal agencies went, that they would stop outsourcing to H-1B visa dependent companies. And, you know, 200 workers were able to save their jobs.
Nice.
Now, do you think that Biden is going to reverse that executive order?
Yeah, it's not looking good. From those who were, like me, kind of restrictionist when it comes to immigration and wanting to see it better regulated and making it work for the workers, it's probably not going to go well for us in this administration coming up.
I think all bets are off after Bernie Sanders. I mean, that was enough of an existential threat to the Democratic Party that they are going to take some of those issues more seriously. The question, I think, is going to be which ones. And immigration, I mean, given what Obama got away with as far as reversing immigration in the wrong direction for
He greatly expanded the OPT, the Optional Practical Training Program.
I was actually referring to the unlawful the detention and export, or detention and deportation.
It'll be interesting to see, because Biden was part of that administration, so we might even see, you know, Biden becoming the deporter in chief again. But the problem, the issue is the corporations, the chambers of commerce, they want a supply of cheap labor. You know, I've been working, you know, when we initially began my organization, we were looking at how immigration was impacting people at the lower skills end of the spectrum, only to find that these non-immigrant work visa programs were threatening people with degrees. So, you know, we've seen displacement of workers at places like Disney, Abbott Labs, Northeast Utilities, SoCal Edison, hundreds of companies that have simply, you know, initially displaced their workers with consulting firms that then would offshore many of those jobs to place, you know, low rent countries like India. And that's been really destructive to the productive class here in America. And
Absolutely. I mean, I drive a bus through Microsoft, so I see it firsthand.
Okay, right, right.
And I have three brothers who've worked for Microsoft in the past. They can give me the lowdown skinny on, you know, one of them went to India to train people how to do his job.
God.
He was moved to another department after that.
Wow.
Well, Jason is a different animal anyway. I don't know if you can crush his soul easily.
Is it that he doesn't have one?
Oh, no. He has a soul. He has a soul. He's just he takes things in a different priority.
Gotcha. Well, that's
thoroughly enjoyed India.
That's kind of been one of the problems with tech workers in the country is they've not done. And if two decades ago, when they were first coming in saying, hey, train your replacement, or, you know, if they would have acted collectively and said, no, if you want us to train our replacements, well, we're going to walk out today. We don't need a 6-month severance package.
Now, maybe this is something that just a general theory, a niggling feeling that I've had. It is not really a firm held thought, but my experience is that a lot of tech workers lean so far to libertarian that Ayn Rand is smiling.
Yeah. Boy, Jim, I think you're spot on there. You know, and they've used it, it's like an Achilles heel in a way, because ultimately, I mean, when you look at the labor movements, you know, my great-grandfather came to the U.S. from Lithuania, and he went to work in the coal mines, you know, died of black lung, but he was an activist. He was one of the Slavic activists that were working with the Irish and the Germans. And, you know, you have to fight for anything in this world, ultimately.
And I'm right now in the middle of listening to an audiobook of King Cole by Upton Sinclair.
Holy shit. Wow.
So that's perfect timing, what you said right there. I don't know if you've read that one, but you
I have
agree.
Not. I have not. But right. I'm going to have to, because, I mean, we forget things like the Hazleton Massacre.
Oh, the Colorado coal strike that went how many months? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm right now working through all the Sinclairs, but it's free. It's online, the audiobook version, LibriVox on King Cole. Also, The Money Changers. But, what went on in the coal mines before the labor movement really got a foothold? Just incredible. Nobody today would put up with it.
No. And it's not that long ago that the real gains were made. I recall I went out to Pittsburgh, and as I was driving across the country, stayed the night with a couple that grew up with my father. And, you know, she was adamant. She said, look, we weren't supposed to have a house like this or cars or anything. Unions gave us that. And so it speaks to collective action. And if workers can't band together effectively, they're toast. Because right now, the impression that I get from the tech worker community and having been involved with them for about 3 years is, you know, great people. But, you know, there's this belief that, wow, I'm really good and they'll never fire me. They'll probably get rid of all the chaff there, but I'm going to be fine. And then eventually they're not. And, right. You know, that's tragic because, you know, it's interesting. It's only this year. You mentioned Microsoft. I know someone, an activist, who works with Microsoft as a contractor, as many people do anymore. And this was the first year in 10 that he's gotten any kind of a raise. I mean, like he said, if you look in terms of real wages, I'm making less than way less than I was 20 years ago when you look at the inflation. But this was the first year, and he got like a $40,000 raise. Why? Because we really tightened up the market. One of the benefits of COVID was the pipeline of labor from overseas got cut off.
Oh, yeah, I never thought of that. Yeah. Yeah, I work, I do a little union work in my workplace, so I wouldn't call myself an expert at all, even though they call me the chief shop steward. I'm really just a functionary trying to make sure that my brothers and sisters don't get overly screwed over, you know, by blatant disregard of contract, things like that.
Because that's about all. I mean, you're really, I feel in a way, someone like yourself, you're that character Hodor from Game of Thrones. You're really, all you can do is hold the door against the demons from coming in.
While they rip you to pieces.
I am now demonstrating that I may be that articulate.
Hold on.
And like to think I know more than one word.
Yeah, what is it, shop steward? What was it? You know, I grew up in the shadow of Bethlehem Steel, so we would run in my family. It was really both management and union and workers who were who would come over and spend, you know, Friday night dining and drinking with my mom and dad. And the stories, you know, like the manager's like, you know, you want to be a shop steward? Who, you got the biggest mouth? Because they're the ones. I was like, and then the union are like, we know they got contracts ready to go. As soon as we give in, they'll make all these profits. So it's a struggle. And it's too bad because from what little I know of Germany, they seem to work in very, they work, the management and workers are collective.
But in Germany, something happened. It was part of the Reconstruction, and it was under Eisenhower. Sinclair goes into this a little bit in his Lanny Buzz series. He went in and pointed out that after the Nazis were defeated, we had the occupations from the four major Axis powers, and well, actually, Russia, Britain, France, U.S. They then tried to get their industry restarted. Well, in the U.S., the generals were going, okay, well, this guy is going to be perfect. He ran it before. And all of his subordinates, which were dyed-in-the-wool union people, they weren't officers of high rank. They were union people. They said, General, he's a Nazi. He's one of the reasons.
Yeah.
He's one of the reasons that the Nazi Party gained traction. And actually, I think DuPont gave them, or I.G. Farben through DuPont's nylon gave the brown shirts their brown shirts. I mean, things went way back. You had IBM giving them the punch card system to sort out all these people they were loading onto lye-covered boxcars. Wow. So they went in and convinced the generals that there had to be some check, not just on political power, but on corporate power. And so one of the arrangements they came up with was something that the New Dealers pointed out might work. In every corporation in Germany, by law, one half of the board of the corporation has to be comprised of workers. So for 1 year, you're a member of the board, even though you're the gardener, or you take out the trash, or you clean the toilets, or you work on the line building the Volkswagens or the Mercedes or the Porsches or whatever it is. So you have this rotating counterweight to a typical corporate board. And because of that, they're also recognized that unions are important and unions can work with the board and with the corporation rather than be the adversarial system that we have in the U.S. today.
And that's, it seems to work really well. I was talking, well, I was in Berlin and I ran into a guy who was a salesman for a HO train manufacturer. They made model trains.
Do you remember the company?
I do not. That's just it, because it wasn't a name that I was familiar with, but they seem to be very high quality in the way he described them.
Because I think I have some of those.
Okay. And
I just don't remember the name. Yeah.
He said, he goes, God, in America, what you do is like anathema to us. You, when you have a downturn, you lay off all these people.
Yes.
Whereas we know things will come back and we're going to need them. So we all take a cut. You know, management down, everyone just takes a cut. You know, they try, do everything they can not to get rid of people. And as right. a result, I mean, that builds loyalty and integrity. And
they go to a 3-day work week for the line. They cut back on bonuses and they get through it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, here in King County, a couple of years ago, Daimler developed a hybrid drive system specifically for transit. Mm-hmm. So instead of having a diesel engine pushing the thing around and then idling and then pushing the thing around idling, they had a much smaller diesel engine that did nothing but generate electricity. And they had a big traction motor drive the bus. Then they had a bank of batteries, and it would serve as kind of a surge capacitor absorbing the load from the generator. So you got a pretty decent reduction in fuel consumption. And because you could run the diesel constantly, you had much cleaner emissions. Win-win. So they decided to get into the North American market. They bought a company in Oneida, New York. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Oneida.
Mm-hmm. Oneida, okay. It was called Orion. And they started putting out the Orion buses with the Daimler drive. And then very abruptly, they pulled out, they closed the factory. All they did was fill existing orders, and our operation was one of the last ones they were filling, and supply parts for the length of their warranty.
Hmm.
My theory is that when they went into the North American market, they went in with the idea that this is a civilized country, so like Germany, they would, during economic downturns, simply spend on public municipal infrastructure, and during upturns, they would, you know, that way you balance out the payments. No. Bus companies, organizations, municipalities are at the whims of the tax base, and so they actually lay off and they cancel orders during economic downturns, and Daimler just looked at that and says, "You barbarians, we are out of here."
Yeah, you got to pay your B&O tax. You got to pay your property taxes. Yeah. And all that goes down and down. That's one of the – that was the nice thing, oddly, about Prop 13 in California, where in the 70s there was a taxpayer revolt. Mm-hmm. And what they said is the most, you know, you can do is – The property tax on a building will be no more than 1.2%, and the increases are limited to this year over year. Now, L.A. would say it was that starved it of cash and everything, but really I think it just prevented a lot of bad behavior, because when that big downturn in 2008 hit, the revenues for the county weren't that badly impacted. Where they were impacted were the fast growth, Ventura County, Riverside County, where they're getting this property tax revenue from all these new builds, and it really messed them up. Whereas, you know, LA County could count on this, and Orange County as well, a very consistent stream of revenue.
Yeah, well, the problem I can see with that, and having talked to people who've owned property in California, you move into a neighborhood and some people have been there for a long time, you're paying four times in property taxes what your neighbor is.
Yeah.
Which I can totally understand. If you're a little old lady on a pension, fixed income, you don't want your property taxes going up like the ones around here have, having to sell your property and move out. On the other hand, it really fixes those who are in early as far as the economic elite.
Well, what they found, oddly, they did find a lot of this property does churn over the years. You would have like a Disney. I mean, that park isn't going anywhere. But those are really the exceptions. Property does tend to churn. And I was like that when I lived in Altadena. You know, my neighbor had a great big place. He had been, you know, his whole career a longshoreman. So he'd been there over 20 years. And compared to the small place that I was living in, his property tax was way less than mine. But, you know, again, you can count on, at least you know what's going to happen, as opposed to like Arizona and Texas, where it's based on the values. And if the values go up, your property taxes go up.
Well, I'm in that situation here in Washington. So, yeah, it would be nice to have some kind of limiting factor on the the property tax increases, but it's not so much that we can't afford it yet. I mean,
well,
two houses down, they sold for $2 million.
Yeah, exactly. King County. Well, the thing, because the driver in California was that, you know, values were just shooting up. And the assessors, the counties, all they had to do was say, you know, all right, we could easily double the property tax based on the value, but, you know, let's just hold it to 10% of what we brought in last year. But they wouldn't do it. The arrogant bastards just wouldn't do it. They literally forced that revolve. And I mean, any thinking person, because people really were being pushed out of their homes. But it just shows the ineptitude of government.
Government is this massive machine. And somebody online put it very well years ago. Government is a bunch of people. And the more you have, the more problems you have. And he said, the larger the collective of people, the more likely it will be impossible to distinguish incompetence from malice.
I like it.
And when you have a big state like California managing all kinds of resources, when you have elected officials that come in and promise the moon but want to deliver the stars, when you have all this pressure on the lowly assessors and the tax revenue people, you have just the recipe for disaster without some kind of controlling legislation like 13 became.
Yeah, and it's interesting. And in a way, you know, this goes back to that small is beautiful concept. I live in a small city now, 55,000. And, you know, when we began to experience the troubles, I'll call it the troubles, you know, the Antifa and, in one case it did get to rioting, like Philadelphia, D.C., Portland, Seattle. Being a small city...
just a couple of miles away from Chaz, baby.
Yeah. Woo! You gotta get some photos of that.
It's over now, so it's not a big deal. But, you know, that one friend we have that lived there loved it. And she's 80.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. No, for her, it was like the 60s. I mean, everybody focused in the media about how lawless and chaotic it was. Really, it wasn't. It was very different. But then you have all kinds of elements coming in to play with the party. That's where things get
broken. Well, that's where things got odd with us. But like I was saying, being a small town, the stakeholders were able to grab a hold of the mayor and the city council and like, no. We've invested this many millions of dollars in the city and you will not allow it to fail. And things just changed overnight. You know, the legal system kicked in, like there was something of a small riot on a Sunday night. Monday morning, the judge gave each of the eight people that were detained $1 million bail each. And that kind of sent a shockwave through the system. And it was like all of a sudden, my city was no longer open for these kind of activities. And by the way, as you had mentioned, we know who the outside provocateurs are. We have you on video, and we know the people you've been collaborating with. So,
well, we know some of the provocateurs. There was a lot of incidents around here where there were people on walkie-talkies who were standing next to a window, and then a walkie-talkie went off, and they'd break the window and they'd walk away. And a bunch of other people would come in and run. And I have a suspicion there were some provocateurs on the right side of the fence as opposed to the left side of the fence, more trying to provoke enough property damage to get a response that could be justified. It sounds like something the current president would be all about, but you know, it's impossible to say. I know the FBI was investigating those incidents.
Well, there were instances, they say, in New York where someone had just dropped off a pile of bricks. Like, how convenient. Throw these around. So that takes some coordination. One, you got to get the equipment to do it. And then you got to be able to do it at a time when no one's looking or you have control of the traffic and are able to do that. So... Yeah, there's...
Well, it's like coordinating things like the videos watching Epstein. If you know who to pay or know who to talk to, it can be done, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And again, I think it goes back, initially we're talking about the presence of a deep state, you know,
right.
Players. And
yeah, and I wouldn't, I don't know if you've read William Goldman. He wrote Marathon Man.
Oh.
Did he write? No, that was Ira Levine for Boys of Brazil. But Marathon Man had a sequel called Brothers. It would never turn into a movie. So you had, was it Dustin Hoffman character? And then
right.
His older brother was in Jaws. I can't remember his name right now. He was not the captain and not Richard Dreyfuss. He was the third guy on the boat.
The biologist, the marine biologist guy.
That was Richard Dreyfuss.
Are you talking about Roy Scheider?
Roy Scheider, yes. Scheider was played the brother of Dustin Hoffman in Marathon Man. He was garroted. In Brothers, the sequel, he survived and went to an island to recover and became kind of a super spy that the powers that be could hold in reserve. And finally, the crisis came where they picked him up and they sent him out. What I loved about the book, and I'm sure it's complete fiction. We can't point to a fictional book and say that's what happens. But there are powers within powers within powers. So you have one group that's dedicated to pushing, for example, we can do anything. We are gods. And another group is we have to kill in order to get power. They're the bloodies. So there's a war between the gods and the bloodies. And the poor agents are just sent out against each other on the same side to, as deftly as possible, manipulate things. So I would not be surprised at all if a bunch of bricks was delivered anonymously by one of the powers that's trying to fight one of the other powers that's trying to not have these things erupt into chaos. But the brick people want the chaos. So we deliver the bricks.
Exactly. And, you know, I believe there are players out there that do not like the nation state. I think they feel it inhibits the ability to maximize profit.
The Kochs.
Yeah, exactly. These neoliberals.
Yes.
And then there are the players that want to see the nation state preserved, but perhaps in a way where they run things, they are the nation state. And then there might be others that might believe in a constitution.
I have to say, boy, the people that want the nation state preserved always seem to be in their diorama of future possibilities in charge. I mean, why can't you just be somebody who wants the nation state preserved and drive a bus? Why do you have to be a senator? Why do you have to be a colonel? Why do you have to be? It just seems convenient.
Yeah. Although, I don't know. I was over the summer, I took a young woman to lunch, and it was pretty hot. And just as we settled into the booth, she unstraps a Glock from her waist, puts it on the table, says, "Boy, I just needed to take that off."
Lighten your load.
Yeah, so that's someone who believes in the nation state. Not necessarily someone looking for power, but, you know.
Well, I know a lot of gun-toting folks that are not necessarily enamored of the big state or the nation state. So, again, you know.
But when I say nation state, I mean, you know, what we have, like, in our Constitution that says, you know, these are the laws. No one's above the law. No one's below the law.
Right.
And,
you know. Checks and balances, folks.
Right.
Yeah.
And then there's the deep state that just see it as their game, I think. And it's funny because when I do speak to people who may not be deep staters, but certainly support that, maybe they're in high government office or their parents were, and they are so frustrated, I think, when they look at, say, a Trump supporter. It's like, what? They really do think they're deplorable. And what they don't realize is, you don't feel that the way they do because you haven't been thrown overboard. Whereas right. these people, 40 years ago, they started throwing us overboard. And then we got NAFTA, GATT, WTO, outsourcing, offshoring. People's lives have absolutely been decimated and they're hopeless. So, yeah, I could.
I can't remember exactly which episode I did. I pointed out that as deplorable as Trump is, he did kill the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I mean, that was the bugaboo that people were talking about, but nobody could even get a copy to read. It was being leaked. That was the ultimate neoliberal deep state stealth action. And here's Joe. Boy, he's all for it.
Yep.
And then there was some general says, no, he has to bring back the TPP. You're a general. What do you care about a trade policy? Please.
But when you're a globalist, you're a globalist.
I know.
Because this is and this kind of brings us back to Dmitry Orlov, too. Because I could see where the Russians feel truly threatened. I mean, NATO was a reaction to the Warsaw Pact.
Yes.
And when the Berlin Wall came down, we should have gotten rid of NATO, just much like we promised Gorbachev that we wouldn't expand. And now we've expanded it,
from SALT II?
Right. Oh, not SALT II, but.
It was SALT II. It was Caspar Weinberger talked to. They were negotiating something and they said, look, we won't push into the Soviet bloc.
Was that during the SALT? Okay.
Not one inch eastward, they said.
Yeah, one exactly. And then suddenly we're pushing into Poland. It's like, oh, that's a bad idea. Yeah. Under Clinton, I believe.
Yeah. Poland and Lithuania are now part of NATO. There is that, like Samuelson's book on... Oh, gosh, I forget. It became really popular after 9/11. I forget. But he talks about how the divide in Europe is really Roman Catholic versus Orthodox. And Poland, Lithuania will side with the West, whereas Serbia and other Orthodox countries will side with Russia, just out of Orthodox.
Okay. Well, you don't have to remember a whole new slew of holidays that way.
Yeah, true that.
Calendrical consistency. It's important when the family is supposed to get together for lunch.
Yeah, we got to know when Christmas is. Do you go by lunar or do you go by,
I do like that in the Orthodox tradition, New Year's is accurately described as the bris of Christ.
Ooh.
Which is why the new year is 7 days after the birth of Jesus, because under the Hebrew tradition, the boy is 7 days old, which represents the 7 days of creation, and the 6 days of creation, on the seventh day, God rested. Therefore, the baby is not really part of the family until the seventh day, and then he can be made a man by losing 80% of the nerve endings in his penis.
Yeah, I think someday we'll be thinking right on that again. But till then.
Till then, we have more staying power because we're numb.
Yeah, I guess so. Oh, golly, guys. Well, this is, it's 3:15. I have another call at 3:30. I wasn't even expecting to jump on. I was like, hey, Camo, how's it going? And I saw your invite. So this has been a lot of fun, but I have a call at 3:30. I'll need a few minutes to prepare for it. But, Jen, this was really awesome meeting you.
It was great meeting you. I'm suddenly placing the voice. You've been on the show before. I'm taking it.
Yes.
You're the guy behind the immigration reform.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Okay. Good to meet you, sir. Great to talk to you.
He's also the guy behind Geb.
I'm sorry?
I said he's also the guy behind Geb.
Right.
Yeah, the Greater Earth Betterment Bureau, and soon to be in hard copy, hopefully by the end of this week. So,
cool.
Right on. Well, gentlemen, this was a lot of fun. Jim, I'm hoping we can do this again with you, me, and KMO. It's been a blast. I mean, it's been didactic because I now have a reading list from you.
Well, stick around long enough, you'll never leave the library.
Ah, there you go. All right, Jim. KMO, you guys
take
care.
See you later,
Kevin.
Bye,
Kevin.
All right, we will leave it there, even though Jim stayed on the call with me for another couple of hours. But, you know, we the conversation thereafter wasn't so focused, and we talked a lot about TV and, you know, very light subject matter. But that's typically how the live streams go. They're not weighty conversations, and my full attention isn't directed at listening to and drawing out the best from my interlocutor. I'm just drawing and chatting with people. Anyway, I do it Monday through Friday. I just finished up a live stream now where I was talking for 3 hours with Philip, who's been a longtime listener to the Sea Realm podcast and somebody who, you know, has a lot of interests that many of you probably share. And all of my live streams are archived on my YouTube channel, although, you know, they're not edited, they're not polished, there are long stretches where there's no sound, it's just me drawing if I don't have somebody to talk to. For the most part, they don't stand alone, unpolished, you know, as a podcast that you could listen to. But if you tune in live, you can interact with other people in the chat, which is all my way of saying, hey, you might think about tuning in to my daily live stream. It is from 2 to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. That's 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. And, you know, it's on my YouTube channel. If you can't find my YouTube channel, send me an email and I will send you a link. My email address is kmo@c-realm.com. All right, that's all. I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.